Support for WPR comes from Lake Superior Big Top Chautauqua, presenting concerts, shows, and events under a big canvas tent in Bayfield, Wisconsin, all summer long. Full schedule, tickets, and info at bigtop.org. Support for WPR comes from the DNR's eCycle Wisconsin program. Many communities will hold electronics collection events this fall. Collection sites and events at dnr.wi.gov. Search eCycle.
Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mehler here, and I've got a great new book for you today on the show. Brandon Keim is the author. He's a freelance journalist, author of the book Meet the Neighbors, Animal, and the subtitle, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. Fascinating book. He says we're surrounded by evidence of animal intelligence, and humans don't have that market cornered, and makes a case for looking at the animals in our neighborhood as neighbors rather than perhaps as interlopers, you might say. And full of fascinating stories and research about animals that make decisions, who are certainly intelligent. And as we talk with Brandon, I hope you'll join in. Have you experienced what you feel are very smart and intelligent wild animals in your neighborhood or somewhere? Do you look at them as your neighbors? Maybe, maybe not. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Brandon Keim, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry. I'm real glad to be here.
Well, I tell you what, I found your book fascinating and enjoyed. It's also written very well. kept me on my toes throughout and interested throughout the whole thing as you talked about intelligence and in animals and your neighborhood. I loved the. Well, I first loved the little insert preface with Fiona Presley and her wounded bumblebee, and I guess we could probably get into that, and maybe we will. But I really enjoyed how you took your neighborhood and talked about the animals in your neighborhood, and maybe you should describe that whole process.
Well, sure. The first several chapters of the book are basically a walk around a fairly typical Eastern North American neighborhood. It was in Bethesda, Maryland, and
you had a cool stormwater pond.
And a great stormwater retention pond. You know, there's so much infrastructure out there that's just full of nature or has the possibility to be full of nature. And that's not narrowly a point about animal intelligence, but I just want to say, if you are managing a stormwater retention pond and you've got that grass mowed down to, you know, within an inch of its life all around the edges, please consider doing some restoration with native wildflowers and creating some habitat. So in the first several chapters, you know, I'm walking around my neighborhood in Bethesda, Maryland, and I'm looking at the animals I encounter there sort of, you know, through the lens of research on scientific research on the intelligence of animals. And, you know, kind of the genesis of that section. As you mentioned, so I'm a science journalist, and, you know, back in the, you know, early 2010s, really throughout that decade, I was really writing a lot about the science of animal intelligence. And, And originally I thought, you know, my book was going to be just about that, you know, just about these findings of snakes having relationships and bumblebee emotions and, you know, self-awareness being distributed throughout the animal kingdom and not just a few extra smart creatures. But over time, I really became, you know, even much more interested in the question of what we do with these insights. And so that broadly is really, you know, what Meet the Neighbors is about. But that first section is still kind of, you know, the distilled form of that original book that I was thinking about writing. And what I wanted to accomplish that, you know, is, you know, I think I see news stories about animal intelligence all the time. You know, this study found this and that study found that. And it can kind of feel abstracted to me in that presentation, you know, like these findings are just, you know, happening on the pages of scientific journals or in labs, and you get all these, you know, really complicated, you know, you get down into the weeds of the methodology of each individual study. I just wanted to make that research come alive and really put it out there on the landscape. And you know, I think anybody's neighborhood is a great place to do that, because wherever you are, you step out the door and there are going to be animals all around you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Scott in Iron River has some animals around him. Let's go there for a minute. Scott, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, absolutely. Nice to be on. I'm thrilled about your work. And my wife and I have a place out in the woods in the Iron River area. And we just, you know, we just kind of coexist with the squirrels and chipmunks. And they run around on our deck, and they don't bother us. We don't bother them. And I guess I just have a general question about behavior with squirrels and chipmunks, but also in relation to bird feeders, that I'm very happy to say I haven't had a squirrel on my feeder in 2 years. and I've used strategies that do not involve firearms. And I just have such admiration for their ingenuity and intelligence. And I looked at it as a challenge, a respectful challenge that I'm happy to say I'm currently winning the battle, but the war will go on, but the battle is in my favor right now. So any comments in regard to that, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. Oh, man. Brandon, comment.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Jeff. Oh my goodness, there's so much to say. We could just spend the next hour talking about squirrels, and really just about the strategies that we all have found to keep squirrels from dominating the bird feeder. I'm curious to hear what you, Vaiga. I've figured out some sort of pull and baffle and like multiple stages of challenges that seems to have worked, except when the snow gets too deep. You know, first of all, it's just really great to hear, you know, that attitude you have towards, you know, the squirrels and chipmunks right outside your door. And, you know, that it's such a simple thing, right? And yet it's so profound, this idea of just, you know, coexisting peacefully with the creatures around us. And when there's some tension, then you find a way to resolve it that is, you know, that is doesn't involve killing, doesn't involve relocating, you know, it just involves trying to modify our own behaviors in a way that, you know, allows space for everybody. And so that's really good to hear. And, you know, I just say on the topic of squirrels, first of all, the epigraph for my book involves squirrel, and it comes from a paper by an anthropologist named Barbara Smuts, who did some extraordinary work on baboons or with baboons in the 1980s. And she was basically living with them, living with a community of baboons. And it just gave her really a new insight into just how rich and complex the lives of wild animals are. And then she also talks in that paper about the relationship she had with her dog, which, you know, of course, nothing more needs to be said. You know, the relationships we have with our dogs are often so profound. There is such a deep communication, whether or not, you know, there's your spoken language involved. And then kind of the light went on for her. And she thought, wait a second, you know, it's every animal out there is an individual and is a somebody. And she kind of had this illumination, you know, looking at a squirrel, which I think is so appropriate because they're so common and just such exceptional creatures.
I sit on my front porch as much as I can, and I read books for the show. I'm usually in this kind of weather. I'm sitting out on the front porch, and there's a squirrel there, and I have lots of flowers that are in ground, but I also have some pots, and there's one pot, it's kind of a long pot. And the squirrel, the same guy, kept digging up one end. And I would put new flowers in, and he would dig up the one end again. And the other flowers, he'd leave. And so finally, I thought, well, why am I putting more flowers in here? So I quit. And then I was sitting out yesterday, and I realized why he was doing this, because he came over, and he's gotten used to me because I'm out on that front porch a lot. And he came over, and he had a black walnut.
There you go.
And he went over to he looked at me he knew I wasn't going to chase after him. And then he went over to that pot, which is kind of a long rectangular pot, and stuck the walnut in the pot.
Covered it.
And he wanted that end. He wanted that end of the pot. So I just left it there. And I was glad I hadn't kept putting more flowers in that end.
Makes you wonder, you know, why was it that one spot? What was it that, you know, made that so appealing to him? And you know, I just want to get in there, you know, apropos of that story that, you know, which I really love. It's really extraordinary when you think about it. So right now, you know, I'm sitting at the edge of a mature forest, and, you know, there's lots of seed and cone bearing trees in there that squirrels love. And when you stop and think about it, squirrels probably planted most of those trees, right? They did something, yeah. You know, just they buried the nut, they buried, you know, and forgot about where it was, or maybe they got eaten first, didn't get a chance to go back to it. And it kind of blows my mind to look out at this forest and think of it not as something that just kind of, you know, sprung into being spontaneously, but that it was really created and produced, you know, by the activity of multitudes of animals, including the squirrels who planted the seeds that grew into the trees. And I kind of like to think about, okay, you know, thanks for the forest, squirrel. So what do I owe you in return, right?
Yesterday, I interviewed Jennifer Holland. She has a book out. It's called Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. And we talked about intelligence in dogs yesterday. And you talk about, obviously, about intelligence and come kind of compare with instinct a bit and talk about research in that area and do it in a delightful way. But you demonstrate and maybe talk about how animals think, feel, and behave in ways that suggest they have intelligence, other than squirrels. I mean, all of the animals, I mean, they have ways to communicate. They have ways to be intelligent. But talk about that.
Well, that is a very big topic, but it's good. My goodness, I'm ready to talk about squirrels for the next 45 minutes. Let me reroute a little bit. So first of all, let me just say that, you know, the science, the way that our ideas about animal intelligence have evolved across, you know, the last couple of millennia. And when I say our, I'm, you know, talking about, you know, sort of people coming from, you know, the Western European or kind of the Enlightenment tradition of knowledge. And, you know, of course, there are a great many other ontologies out there, especially, you know, indigenous pretty much every Indigenous ontology that I've ever heard of, you know, that all regard other animals as thinking, feeling beings, you know, with whom we really share a lot in common on the inside. You know, but the particular knowledge tradition that that prevailed and that, you know, is kind of, you know, the way that most of us are socialized is mm-hmm. that, you know, what came out of quote unquote the West. And you really, you can look back at the last 2000 years, you know, more than that, you know, start off with Aristotle, who, you know, asserted that animals are really only capable of feeling pain and hunger, you know, and he's responsible for kind of, you know, having a taxonomic arrangement of animals with, you know, with humans on top and a hierarchy yeah. of animals below that described not only their relationships to one another anatomically, but also created kind of a moral and intellectual hierarchy as well. You know, you can trace a line from that on through medieval Christian theologians who were just really bent on replacing pagan, you know, quote unquote, pagan ideas about the commonality between humans and animals with an idea of human exceptionalism and what it is that set us apart from other creatures, which, you know, they seized upon our minds and our rationality and our ability to speak and so on as being, you know, as being what quote unquote made us human and therefore different. You know, and then on to, you know, René Descartes and the scientists and philosophers of the Enlightenment, you know, who, you know, Descartes famously compared animals to, to mechanical wind-up toys, right? You know, they move and they give the appearance of life, but it's all just springs and clockwork. You know, and then go on through that to the, you know, to the science of the early 20th century, which really laid down the legacy that we're kind of digging out from now. And all across that time, you do have many people pushing back and saying, wait a second, animals are very intelligent. You know, they have a lot going on in there, you know, but that side lost. And so basically throughout much of the 20th century, the conventional scientific wisdom was that, you know, animals are just not meaningfully intelligent. And now, of course, in everyday life, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, ways that people know that that's not the case and say, oh, wait a second, well, I've got a cat or a dog, I'm a farmer, I know my horses and my cows. You know, these are obviously very intelligent, sensitive creatures. So it's not like that idea was ever fully extinguished, you know, but it wasn't serious. You could kind of push back against it and call it anthropomorphic. And it was easy to kind of turn it off, right? So now I grew up in a world where, yeah, I recognize the intelligence of my cats and dogs, but somehow the idea that every squirrel out there, every wild animal out there, you know, is also meaningfully intelligent is kind of this conventional wisdom overturning proposition. So all that is the history. And but now, you know, now we really are just in this wonderful moment of scientific research into animal minds, and there's so many great studies, but a few of my favorite, this is more than a decade now, but there are a group of researchers, their names are escaping me. I'm going to say Melissa Bateson. I hope I didn't get that wrong, but so they were studying the emotions of bumblebees or the feelings of bumblebees, mm-hmm. and they used what are called cognitive bias tests, and you know, that's could get down into the weeds on the experimental details, but basically it comes down to, you know, do you see the glasses half full or half empty? And for humans, if you're in a good mood, it's half full. If you're in a bad mood, it's probably half empty. And you can kind of replicate that with bees, not by presenting them with a glass half full of water, but by giving them, you know, let's say training them to expect a sugary reward if they press a green button, and or, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, or, you know, get a bitter reward if they, you know, press the red button. And then so you give them a color that's halfway in between. Now, are they going to press that button? Are they going to take the chance that it's sweet and not bitter? And if they're in a good mood, they'll take that chance. And so, you know, just using that really clever methodology, she was able to get at the experiences of bumblebees and how they're you know, their kind of momentary emotional states of being stressed or feeling good played out across time and became what we would call moods. You know, they're happy, mm-hmm. they're sad, they're in a good mood, they're in a bad mood. And, you know, there's just something about, you know,
I thought that was so fascinating.
I mean, you look at a bumblebee.
I thought
so
it was
fascinating. You know, they're so different than us. Oh, yeah, as you can see, so different than us, and yet there is that core fundamental similarity.
If they're in a good mood, they'll take that in the middle color. And if they're not in a good mood, maybe not. They're going to do something else. Well, we're going to keep going on this, yeah. Brandon. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll continue to be with us. Brandon Keim, last name is spelled K-E-I-M, and his book is Meet the Neighbors, subtitle Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking today with author Brandon Keim. His book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. At noon today, by the way, we'll talk with two rehabilitators of Native Wisconsin Wildlife in Oconomowoc. And then at 12:30, some DNR research scientist shares what was learned from a study of 68 collared coyotes in southern Wisconsin. So we have all that coming up. But right now, Meet the Neighbors. And you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Martha in Menominee will give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry, this is really fun. I have a crow that visits my peanuts that I throw out for him. I've named him Dewey Crow after the character in the series Justified because he's a little bit of a rogue. Anyway, I'm wondering if your guest has read this book called Gifts of the Crow. It's by John Marchleff and Tony Angel, and it talks about how crows can identify facial features of humans. It's a really good book, and I'm wondering if, besides your guest's book, and this book, if there's any others that he can recommend about crows.
You talk about crows. I mean, you talk about crows and really some fascinating research on crows and actually rats too, who can remember things, recognize patterns, yeah. and solve problems. Amazing.
Oh, so crows in particular. So you know, John Marchleff is he's. Out there, I believe it's in Washington, and I reference some of his work in the book. He does fascinating stuff, and I'm trying to think of other books about crows specifically. Of course, there's Bernd Heinrich's book about ravens, which not the same thing as crows, but there's going to be some overlap there. And there's a guy named Thomas Van Doren. He's a sort of environmental historian and theorist who has written a lot of just really deeply thoughtful works about many animals. But he has written about corvids as well. And I can't remember if it's a book or a chapter in a book, but if you look up Thomas Van Doren, D-O-O-R-E-N, you'll find that and some other work of his as well, and you won't be disappointed. And, you know, I would also just toss into the mix. So one of the things that I, you know, talk about in my book is really over the last 10 or 20 years or so, you know, it's not just the science of animal intelligence that has flourished, but all sorts of scholarship about animals. There's been something in the humanities that's called the quote unquote the animal turn, which is just basically, you know, all of these, you know, historians and anthropologists and social scientists and literary theorists and what have you, you know, really turning their attention to animals in a meaningful way. And just the scholarship that's come out of that, you know, it can be kind of wonky and academic, but there's just so many interesting ideas out there. And if you just kind of hop on, you know, Google Scholar and, you know, type in crow animal studies or something like that, you'll find so much interesting thinking about crows that is really building on the science and kind of saying, okay, well, what do we do with this now? We have this sense of crows as being intelligent and being somebodies and being beings who are out there in the world. So kind of where do we go from there? And it's interesting stuff.
Yeah, Martha, and be sure to take a look at Brandon's book, Meet the Neighbors, as well, because there's a lot on crows and rats in there. You know, and you do have some really interesting research on crows and discussions on them. You know, I wouldn't say easy, but it's easier to study animals' traits like intelligence, learned behavior, than, say, emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, emotions are difficult to study in human beings, much less animals, and at least with humans, you know, I can tell you how I feel, and that's not always the case with animals. And this is starting to change, but there's still really a long way to go. And I think this is, you know, something to keep in mind is that, you know, all these creatures out there on the landscape, you know, they're not just intelligent in the sense of, you know, remembering things and being able to solve problems and, you know, planning for the future and what have you. You know, but they also have an emotional, you know, their intelligence also encompasses emotions. They're also feeling. And I mentioned that, of course, with bumblebee emotions being a great example. But, you know, right now, one of the things I love to do in fall, as I'm sure many of your listeners do, you know, is just be aware of the fall migration, right? These great rivers, birds who are, you know, flying overhead and stopping on by as they make their way south. And that's usually something that's understood, you know, as a, you know, an extraordinary physiological accomplishment, a great feat of navigation. But you don't often sort of think about, you know, the emotional experience of flying 4,000 miles from the boreal forest to South America. And there are a few scientists who have started, you know, to study now the social relationships of migrating groups of birds. And one of my favorite studies comes from some biologists who tracked the migrations of a species called European bee eaters. And so they make these flights from, you know, from Western and Central Europe all the way to equatorial Africa. And what the researchers found is that they're making those flights, you know, with friends and family, right? Those groups stay together that whole time. And if they get separated, then they, you know, usually reunite with one another at the end, you know, but if, you know, of course the researchers aren't studying how that feels, but you can just imagine, you know, how happy you are, like, to see your mate after you've been separated and reunited 4,000 miles away. And, you know, there's just such a resonance to adding emotions onto all the other forms of intelligence we recognize in animals.
And you do write about some research there was on birds in flight. I don't know if it was geese, but they have a method of conversing. Their songs, and I mean, that's their language, but they can talk among themselves as they fly about who's going to go first, or, you know, do we need to change, or what direction do we go? I thought that was really fascinating.
Oh, it's, you know, so I guess maybe I grew up sort of thinking of, you know, groups of animals. You've got a leader, you know, usually he's going to be the key. Notice I said he is going to be the biggest and the strongest and, you know, animal of all. But there are so many species, including, you know, many bird species, who, you know, their leadership, you know, they're not just dominated by a leader. They are collectively making decisions about who to follow and what to do. And pigeons are a really interesting example of this, where, you know, you see a flock of pigeons flying overhead. You know, they'll be following a leader, but their leader can change. And, you know, if the leader isn't, you know, doesn't seem to have very good knowledge of the route they're following, you know, they'll say, okay, we're going to follow somebody else here, right? And, you know, how that is sort of, you know, worked out on the fly, I think is still something people are figuring out. But there are examples of with geese deciding whether to take off. And, you know, the way that they kind of, they vote through honking, right? And when the frequency of honks in the groups reaches a certain intensity, then that's when they say, okay, all right, fine, we'll go. And then they take off, you know, as a group. And yeah, animal communication, there's so much to learn. But you know, but hey, if you're following the bird migration, you're out there at night and you can hear the birds passing overhead, and you just hear those calls, those contact calls they make to each other, keeping in touch, letting each other know who's who, you know, coming down out of the night sky towards you at this time of year. It's a special thing.
Jeff in Duluth, Minnesota has something about conversations and talking, I believe. Jeff, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Yes, I am in Duluth, but we have a cabin in northwestern Wisconsin on Lake Minnesowing, and I have a comment that kind of evolves into a question. A couple of months ago, we were sitting on our deck, and we heard the loons start calling, which fairly common for us, still unique and fun to hear. But what would respond surprised all of us, and we had more than one witness to this, was some sort of canine creature. Could have been a wolf, could have been a coyote, could have even been a dog. But this went on three rounds of three. So the loon would call, the canine would respond, the loon would call, the canine would respond. I mean, it was really a call and response kind of episode. I've never heard of it before. None of my friends have ever heard of it before. In fact, some of my friends look at me like I'm very strange, but I'm wondering if the guest has ever heard of such a thing. Because you have now, because I swear to God it happened.
Jeff, thank you for calling. What do you think, Brandon?
Wow, I've heard of that now. That is an amazing story. What a treat. What a privilege to hear that.
I've never heard of it either, and it's really a cool thing to have heard. I am sure of that, Jeff. Karen in Madison, we'll go to you and then to Rachel. Karen, hi.
Hi. I've got a quick story. It's kind of sad, but there was a crow in my yard that got caught in a woven wire fence. I didn't realize it until it had been there a while and was flapping around. So I was heartbroken, and I went out with gloves, and I was speaking softly to it and trying to save it, but unfortunately, when I finally got it untangled from the fence, it died in my hands, and I was heartbroken. But it had its whole family was around, and they came down and swooped around me and were circling me as I was holding this crow, and were calling, and they weren't dive bombing me, but they were. You know, circling above my head. And so I put the body of the crow down on a rock in my backyard and went back inside and just watched. And all afternoon, this whole flock of crows sat vigil over this body. Mm-hmm.
And you write about this in your book, Brandon, something similar.
Yeah. So thank you for sharing that story. That's really powerful. Apropos of what we were talking about a moment ago with emotion. So there have been studies of how crows respond to the bodies of dead conspecifics, as it's called. And the way that the findings from those studies have been reported in the popular press is that, you know, crows, you know, what we call crow funerals is really just crows, you know, basically acquiring information about how that individual died, because that information could, you know, be really very relevant to their own to their own lives. And, you know, and that's unquestionably seems to be the case. But, you know, there is also that other dimension of, you know, the social bonds and the emotional response. And, you know, that's not something that the researchers are trying to measure. It's on their minds, but they're not sure how to go about it in an ethical way. And, you know, and so that's really not part of the research. And then the way that the findings get reported is just, you know, sort of all about information acquisition and, you know, nothing about, you know, emotions or the idea of grief or, you know, acknowledging the passing of death. And yeah, you know, that is just such a really powerful example of it. Thank you.
Karen, thank you. Rachel in Eau Claire, thank you for waiting.
Hi. I wanted to bring up beavers and their engineering prowess. I took a wildlife ecology course when I was in college, and our task was to doing a project on estimating the beaver population in Itasca State Park in Minnesota. And so my partner and I were backcountry checking out every dam that we could find, and we found one dam that had been broken in the middle, and the beavers had repaired it by making a rectangle in front of the break. And we thought that was completely ingenious, because if you try to put a stick in the middle of a break, it's just gonna wash away. But I don't know a lot of humans who would have been able to figure that out. So my comment, and I will take your response off the air.
Thank you, Rachel. That's an example, and it's something you also write about, Brandon, in your book.
Yeah, so beavers figure prominently in a chapter about personhood, which you should buy the book and read that chapter. But just about the example you gave, what a really fun thing to be able to do, just roaming around looking at beaver dams. Oh my God, I would love to do that. And the example you gave, though, right? Like, that's something that, you know, not long ago, and even today, some people would still just say, oh, well, you know, beavers making dams, it's purely instinctive. You give a baby beaver a bunch of sticks, and they're probably going to try to, you know, stack them up, that there's no thought involved. And then you see something like that where, no, right? There is clearly thought. There is clearly an understanding of physical properties, and also probably techniques that have been developed over the course of a beaver's life, or even over multiple generations, because that knowledge is being passed on socially. And I'm not aware of any research on the cultural transmission of knowledge in beavers, and, you know, the cultural transmission of dam building and repairing techniques. But I would love for some scientists to get out there and study that, because I think, you know, there is a lot of research on animal culture now, but it tends to be more, you know, animals like elephants or chimpanzees, who are kind of recognized as being extremely intelligent and are also very long-lived. But I think, you know, cultural transmission is happening all the time. Also, you know, and cultural bodies of knowledge are accumulating all the time, also in animals like beavers and other creatures who we don't usually think of through that lens. So if there are any researchers listening to this, please, please do that study.
Cultural knowledge. I was remembering, well, a couple of things about beavers, but I was reminded of birds and a study you reported on that was done a long time ago of, I don't know if it was really a study, but there were some birds, a certain bird, and this is back in 1930s or something, that in one town learned to take the caps off of milk jugs that were sitting on people's front porch.
Mm-hmm.
And then
it was in.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it was in the town of Swathing, England, is where it started. And this is kind of, you know, one of the landmark studies of cultural transmission in animals. And you know, because bird watchers in general, and then especially British bird watchers, are very rigorously observant people. There were records of this behavior occurring, you know, first in Swathing, and then in the towns nearby, and then the towns around them. And so, you know, by watching how this behavior progressed across the landscape, you know, then it was clear that these birds were learning from each other, right? It wasn't just, you know, like they all figured out how to do it at the same time or in some sequential way. And yeah, they, you know, they were popping the tops. Well, I guess some of your listeners are going to be young enough that this might won't make sense to them without the explanation that once upon a time, yeah. milk was delivered in bottles left on people's doorsteps. And in between the moment the delivery man dropped it off and the homeowner opened the door and brought the milk inside, birds would have a chance to pop the tops off the bottles and get at the milk themselves.
Amazing story. One of the amazing stories that Brandon Keim talks about in his book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Lives, Animal Minds, and Life in a More Than Human World. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Brandon Keim about his book, Meet the Neighbors, subtitle Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. Brandon, you write about one, you have many things we haven't talked about yet in your book. One of them was the Non-Human Rights Project, which I think was founded in 2007, perhaps, somewhere in there, by Stephen Wise.
That's right, somewhere in there. And, you know, Stephen, who passed away earlier this year, is, so he was an animal rights attorney. And he came to believe that, you know, really the great fundamental problem that he was, you know, fighting against is that animals are considered property in the eyes of the law. There's no such thing as of now in the United States as an animal who is truly considered a person. And by person, I mean, in this context, an entity capable of bearing rights. And sometimes when people write about the Non-Human Rights Project, they'll say stuff like, oh, you know, should animals have the same rights as humans? And Steve would always say, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, can animals have any rights at all? And the first right that he sought was for the right to be physically free, the right to bodily liberty for captive chimpanzees in New York State. And then later on, what I wrote about, he and the Non-Human Rights Project filed a series of lawsuits on behalf of captive elephants, including an elephant named Happy, who is now captive at the Bronx Zoo in New York. And, you know, something that I think was really compelling and powerful about the case that Stephen called into being is that, you know, he was appealing to the bedrock principles of Western democracy and Western civilization and saying, listen, you know, if the science shows in the case of chimpanzees and then elephants that they possess all of the qualities that we consider important for autonomy, so that they're self-aware, they reflect upon the past, they think upon the future, you know, they live in complex societies, communicating with one another, and following cultural norms, you know, everything that we say, well, this is, you know, if human beings do these things, then we need to treat them as people. And, you know, really a fundamental right of a human being is a right not to be arbitrarily imprisoned. Well, you know, if you have an animal who meets all those criteria, then why shouldn't we say that is a person with the right to be free as well? And, you know, really the arguments against that logic come down to, well, because it's complicated, meaning if you grant personhood to a chimpanzee or an elephant, then pretty soon people will be asking for personhood for pigs and chickens. And rather than having a grown-up conversation about that, let's just sweep it under the rug and not even say that chimps or elephants can be people. The rejection will just come in the form of, well, because they're animals, right? It's you know, that's fundamentally what it's about. Rights are for humans. Animals are not human. Therefore, animals can't have rights. You know, and what Steve would always say is, you know, that type of thinking where you just have some arbitrary difference that basically amounts to they look different than us, and it's not in our interest to respect their rights, that always goes to bad places in human contexts. And something that was just so impressive to me is that, you know, these ideas, I think really they appeal to our better angels. And so many people were interested and are interested in the Non-Human Rights Project, you know, who are not animal rights people, who eat animals, but, you know, but those ideas are so powerful and so compelling that, you know, you just, that they're really worth thinking through. And I think the Non-Human Rights Project has just done an extraordinary job of articulating that.
You use an example, I guess it may be the only example in the country of New York City that has an Office of Animal Rights.
Yes. You know, so sort of the next step up from thinking of animals as persons, whether it's in a legal sense or just in an everyday way, right? Like there's all sorts of situations in which, you know, personhood isn't about legal rights. It's just about how we treat one another. But the next step up from that, you know, is thinking about representation for animals in the institutions where decisions are made that affect their lives. And, you know, that's the essence of democracy, right? If you're affected by something, then you get a voice in the decision. And the way that New York has put this, you know, this principle into action is just by having somebody in the mayor's office whose job it is to talk to other people in government or people in the community, you know, about animal issues and to try to advocate on behalf of animals when decisions that are being made about them. And this isn't a person, you know, as of now, they don't have a voting capacity. There is not an animal representative on New York City Council, but I love to imagine what that would look like.
But they have had successes. I mean, just what
they have. I was just going to say, finding ways of dealing with goose conflicts around the airport that, you know, involved just basically trying to get the geese away from the area and managing the habitat differently rather than just killing endless numbers of geese, using sterilization programs for deer on one of the islands where deer are really getting overpopulated and posing a traffic hazard. There's been some great advances with, you know, animal friendly bill design that, you know, that this office has pushed for. And it's just really cool to think that if you're a person in New York and you're concerned about animals in some way, maybe, you know, somebody's paving over a little pond in your neighborhood that, you know, the turtles use or something, you can call the Office of Animal Welfare. And there is somebody in government whose job it is, whose duty it is to advocate on behalf of the animals in New York City. And that's a cool thing.
It is a cool thing. And just to take it in a different area, and here we've only got about a minute or so to talk about it, but Brad Gates, who is in the animal removal business and homes, does it humanely.
Mm-hmm.
And has come up with ways that people like.
Yeah, he's the, you know, so Brad Gates, you know, he operates a company called AAA Wildlife Removal in Toronto, Ontario. And he's kind of the, you know, the great grandfather of the whole field of humane wildlife removal and wildlife conflict resolution. And one of his innovations is that, you know, he takes a raccoon or a squirrel out of your attic, he just releases that raccoon or squirrel outside, right? Doesn't chuck them off into the, you know, into the woods somewhere, into a place that, you know, the raccoon or the squirrel doesn't know and is probably going to die there. You know, he leaves them in the neighborhood, which is their home too, and then makes sure they can't get back into your house. And if I have time just to recount one anecdote, one of Brad's favorite stories involves a raccoon who he had to remove from somebody's garage. And so he gets there and the garage door is closed, right? And he can't figure out how the heck did this raccoon getting in the first place. And so he goes to catch the raccoon and the raccoon, you know, runs down one of the support beams, hits the automatic garage door opener button, waits for the garage door to open and then runs out. And it turns out
that's what he was doing.
Out, this raccoon. Every single night after everybody went to sleep, this raccoon would climb down, open the garage door, go out into the neighborhood, do their thing, and come back early in the morning, close the door before anybody woke up and even knew that anything had happened.
A great story and a great way to end. Brandon Keim, thank you so much for being with us today. His book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. We haven't covered it all, believe me. Take a look at it. You're going to enjoy it. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, last hour we talked with Brandon Keim about his book, Meet the Neighbors, and one of the chapters had to do with a rehab center, a wildlife rehab center in his area out east, as a matter of fact. Well, now we're going to talk about a rehab center that is located right here in Wisconsin, and a couple of guests for you today. Kim Bannock, Executive Director of the Wildlife in Need Center. It's a rehab of native Wisconsin species located in Oconomowoc. Kim Bannock, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us. We're so thankful.
With us as well, Elisa Fosco, Director of Animal Care of Wildlife in Need. And Elisa, thank you for joining in as well.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
As you listen to our experts, I hope you'll join in. Have you taken a wildlife animal to a rehab center? Do you know when an animal is in need? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Kim, your center is located in Oconomowoc, serves southeast Wisconsin. Talk about your mission.
So our mission is to help injured, orphan, and sick Wisconsin wildlife, and a goal is always to release them back to the wild. And we also have a wildlife education program. So we go anywhere from Madison to Milwaukee, even like 2.5 hours north, with our educational ambassadors. Wildlife hospital is very unique, and it is there to serve our community with the injured, orphan, and sick Wisconsin wildlife that we admit.
So. Yeah, it's a great service. Elise, and you serve Wisconsin animal species that are common to our state, correct?
Correct. We do take care of all native species that we have the resources to take care of and that we can legally rehabilitate in Wisconsin.
And what kinds of animal injuries do you typically treat?
You know, we see all different things that come in the door, but as far as injuries, probably the most common things that we see, unfortunately, almost all of them due to some sort of human interaction. But typically, the main things that we would see would be vehicle collisions, window collisions, especially during migration months, and then dog and cat caught animals, so non-native domestic predators, basically, when people have their pets outside. So those would be the most common types of injuries that we see. But then we also do take care of orphaned and sick animals as well.
It's an amazing job that you do there. Kim, I understand the center celebrated its 30th anniversary earlier this year. And by the way, you have a great Facebook page. And that's one of the changes I expect that's happened over the past three decades.
Yes, it is one of the great changes. It's a great way to get our message out there to our Facebook followers. It's a very efficient way to do that. So, this year is our 30th anniversary, and we're really excited about that. We've seen some unprecedented admission numbers this year, where just April alone, we had 70% increase compared to previous years of animal admissions. Currently right now we're at about 40% on average compared to previous years. And we recently admitted our 70,000 patients since inception and our 2,000 patients this year alone. And we're not even, done with the busy season yet. So
yeah. And you have fewer than, I think, a dozen people, a paid staff, but you also have a couple of hundred volunteers, which you probably really need to handle that volume.
Yeah, I mean, so we take care of as many animals that we can, and it really does take a whole combined effort everything from our medical staff to our rehab staff to our longtime volunteers to our brand new volunteers. And then in the summer, our interns as well. And so there's quite a lot of people that go into helping the animals that come through our facility, for sure.
Yeah. Joshua in Viroqua has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Joshua.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, so just last week, I was in the Waukesha area, far from home, and I was on a farm, and I was going to meet someone, but they weren't there, and as I was waiting, I heard something on the fence line, and there was a fawn with its right rear leg tagged in a fence, and it had cut to the bone. I could see the bone. It was about a 40-pound fawn with spots. I'm guessing it was the biggest spotted fawn I'd ever seen, but I thought this thing is going to cut me up if I try and handle it, but I was able to bend the wire enough so I could get away, and it looked just terrible. And it was such an upsetting experience. I just wondered if there was anything better I could have done.
You got it loose.
Yeah, I mean, those situations are really challenging. And most places in Wisconsin are not able to rehabilitate white-tailed deer. Did you see the mom around?
No.
When it happened? Okay. So, you know, it's pretty common for those guys to get stuck in all kinds of fences, unfortunately. And, you know, they don't typically do well if they cannot get up and walk away. If they can get up and walk away, a lot of times what we'll do, and it can be very challenging, is we will have people... And we'll say, you know, if he gets up and runs away, leave him alone and let him do that, because they do have a pretty good chance. And there are a ton of three-legged deer out there in the wild breeding and doing well. Now, if we were to rehabilitate them, we would never amputate limbs on a wild animal. But in the game of survival of the fittest, there's quite a few out there that do okay. So typically we try to give them the benefit of the doubt. There's not much that you can do besides either A, get them out like you did, or B, call the sheriff who could come out. And if they can't be let go or they can't get up and walk, then the sheriff can take care of them.
Yeah.
Ideally, though, whenever possible, we do try to give them a chance. And it's hard to say about that guy without kind of seeing what the leg looked like. But if they can get out and walk on all 4 feet, it's definitely worth the chance. So the right thing to do is to try to get them out like you did.
Sometimes
a bit rough.
Yeah, you did the best you could there,
yeah.
Josh, and it was pretty good, I think.
Yeah. As long as he walked away, that's the same thing we would have done.
Thank you again for calling. Cheryl in Milwaukee will go to you. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Larry. We used to live up in Conover, north of Eagle River, and I cannot tell you how many animals I rescued and took to the Northwoods Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in Minocqua. And I can't tell you the amount of wonderful work these people do. It's just incredible. Their love and attention to our wildlife is just beyond comprehension. And the gentleman with the fawn deer, I remember one time in St. Germain, literally a car on Highway 70, literally and on purposely hit a fawn. It wasn't an accident. You could see it. And so I called the sheriff. I stopped. I took the fawn to the wildlife place. The sheriff gave this lady a ticket because she obviously wasn't trying to avoid the animal. She ran right into it, smack into it.
Well, Cheryl, that's a terrible thing that happened, certainly in that instance. But she mentioned, and Cheryl mentioned the Northwoods Rehab mm-hmm. Center. You probably have had some dealings with Marge and the folks there as well, or maybe at least a conversation once in a while.
Yeah, Marge would be up a bit further north than them, and Northwoods, they're all good facilities, you know. We all try to do the best that we can to help the animals that come through our doors. Northwoods is another good one that takes a lot of animals and does really good work. And unfortunately, you know, And I, you know, we could spend all day talking about all the bad things that happen out there when people are behind the wheel of a car and an animal gets in front of them. But, you know, we try to do the best that we can. And I'm really thankful and happy to hear that there was actually a ticket given for that. That's not common. So it's good to hear that there's at least some follow-up. But, yeah, those situations are never good.
Yeah. Cheryl, thanks again for calling. Nancy in Ridgeland. Thank you for calling, Nancy.
Well, I'm so glad to talk with you, Larry. I want to congratulate Kim and Alicia for continuing the work that was started those 30 years ago at the Wildlife and Needs Center. I was the director then, and I started the program, and I'm so delighted that it lives on and continues to do the good work that we started way back then.
Nancy, thanks.
Awesome. Thank you. It's good to hear.
Good to hear your voice.
Oh, wonderful. Nancy, thank you so much. I want to go back to the education that you do, because even on the Facebook page, I learned quite a bit. Sorry to hear about Meadow, your bull snake. And that was part, and Meadow was, I think, part of your education efforts.
She was, yes.
Mm-hmm. So talk about what you do in that area, in the area of education, not necessarily just Meadow, but other things.
Yeah. So globally, what we do is we're just trying to teach people how to live harmoniously with our Wisconsin wildlife and just, you know, give them tools, ways to either if an animal needs help and help them understand when to bring an animal to us, or when an animal is just fine and it should be left alone. We work with the public to try to help them understand, like, you want to call before you kidnap. And we say that especially during orphan season, because sometimes you see a baby alone does not mean that it is alone, but sometimes it is an orphan. So our education works with all ages, not just, you know, school. It's all ages. I just did a program, and our youngest children there were 1 year old. And we go all over the place to schools and even up to senior centers. So, and it's really just to teach people how to live harmoniously with our wild neighbors.
Yeah, it's a great program. The phone recording people hear when they call the center right now says you're at capacity with baby raccoons. And you, on your Facebook page, you have a great video of some young raccoons catching minnows in a tub. But why do we have so many raccoons in particular?
You know, unfortunately, raccoons, and we love our baby raccoons, but they are one of the mammals that just takes the most time and resources to raise them. And on top of that, the most caging space. And so, you know, we do have minimum standards that we have to follow, and it's for their best interest to raise them right. And so basically what happens is that, you know, the most common situation would be that people hear something in their attic, under their deck, under their garage, whatever it is, and they will trap a raccoon or have it trapped and have it taken away or euthanized. And then 2 days later, they find a bunch of babies that they think are really cute, and now they want to save them. And so I would say the majority of our raccoons come in like that, where they are intentionally, whether or not it was known, but they were basically orphaned by the people who either killed or moved the mother. And so the majority of the calls that we get are for those, unfortunately. And then we also get calls where people, you know, just simply there's a car hit raccoon, and then there's a couple babies that come out crying a couple of days later. So there are just so many that we get calls for. And unfortunately, us, as well as all the centers, we fill up pretty quick on raccoons. And after that, it is very, very challenging, because people find them, they're cute, they're adorable. But, you know, if we don't have caging capacity for them, we can't take them. And so people that find their baby raccoons in April, they can usually find someone to take them. But once it gets into June, every rehab center is at capacity. So it's a challenging situation. And we have actually redone all of our raccoon cages to try to, you know, help with our raccoon program. But still, we can fill up in a matter of days at the beginning of the season, which is very hard. So we work very closely with the people that find them to do everything in their power to reunite them. So if people call us before they have the mother trapped, it's a really simple thing. We give them a couple tricks on how they can get mom to take her babies away and then to seal up the hole after she leaves. But if they don't call us first and they call a pest control company, that's where we get into problems with the babies being orphaned.
Yeah.
So, you know, best scenario is people call when they find them, and then there are no orphans. And that's what we try to do. But, yeah, we do fill up as, you know, it's one of the hardest things with what we do is not being able to take baby raccoons that are in need of help.
Yeah.
It's really challenging.
And, you know, I mentioned that video of the young raccoons catching minnows, but there's an educational component to that, too, that I learned as I read the information along with the video itself.
Well, that's good. That's what we're trying to do.
Excellent. Perfect. Well, you know, you were teaching them.
Absolutely.
Catch minnows and use their hands.
Right. And I mean, these guys, you know, raccoons are very smart. They're extremely smart. And so they spend a lot of time learning and going out foraging with their mother. When they're raised in captivity, they don't have that training. And so, you know, it's like growing up in the system without individual parental attention. It's a different thing. And so with these guys, we want to teach them they have to be able to climb. They have to be able to hang from trees. They have to be able to catch food and use their hands the way that they would in the wild and dig. It takes a lot to keep them mentally healthy and mentally stimulated, because with their mother, they would be out every night, you know, going in the creeks and learning what everything is. And without that, you can get pretty bored pretty quick. So we do try to do everything that we can, both for enrichment, for behavioral stimulation, but also for training to make sure that they have the life skills that they need when they're released. We do not ever want to raise an animal that ends up a nuisance animal going into someone's trash cans. That's just not for everything that we do for them. We want them to have a really good chance at a good life expectancy after release and not get themselves into trouble. So a lot of those things like the minnow hunting and digging for things and foraging, those are all the skills that we try to give them so that they can have a really good chance at success when they leave.
It's wonderful. So you're kind of educating the animals and you're educating the people.
We try, you know, we want our animals, again, you know, wildlife rehab is not the place for healthy babies to be. We do everything in our power to try to reunite them with their families and working with the public to prevent them from coming in if there's any chance that they can stay with their natural family. If they do come in because they can't stay with their natural family, we kind of look at it as a last resort. But that said, we want to do the best thing for them. And some of these really intelligent animals, it's pretty hard to raise them well when they learn so much from their parents. And so we've learned different ways to kind of do well by them and make sure that those things are happening. But it does take a lot more work than just putting them in a cage and adding food.
Yeah.
For sure.
And food is, I mean, how are you funded? You started feeding all these animals, just the food alone. It's got to be.
That's a really good question. So we are a not-for-profit. So we operate 365 days a year based on generous donors, based on our fundraising efforts. We do write some grants, so we have some great organizations that do support us out there. But it's all generous donors and all of our fundraising events, you know, the need is there. It's
And I'm wondering about the training. I've often thought about this for a while. I mean, there aren't a lot of places where you can learn about how to take care of a wild animal, are there?
Not really. So we do have a pretty small field, but there are a lot of training opportunities available if people are interested in learning how to do this on their own. In Wisconsin, we have the advantage of having multiple large centers. So people are kind of interested in just learning and spending some time working with wildlife, can always volunteer at a local center, ours included. You know, like we said earlier, we rely very heavily on our volunteers for everything that we do with our animals. And so our volunteers and the people that would sign up at wildlife centers, that would be how they get their education. You can apply in the state of Wisconsin to get a wildlife rehab permit, and that would involve having facilities for it and working with an advanced licensed rehabilitator from Wisconsin to get training before getting your own permit. So there's a whole process for it. But again, you know, it is very much a new field. We are still very primitive and learning as we go, doing the best we can. But we do now have a lot of science to back up our practices, and we spend a lot of energy trying to teach that stuff to new people coming in because, you know, there's no school you can go to.
Yeah. I wondered if For example, if volunteers ever wind up, maybe at your place or maybe other centers as well, a volunteer wind up as a an employee.
They do.
That's where almost all of our employees come from. Yeah.
Because I started as a baby bird feeder volunteer way back in 2009 with my son. Lisa Rowe, our director of operations, she has been with the organization since 1995. 1995, she was a volunteer. But back in about 20 years ago, she came on as staff. So, you know, there's a lot of us come as from the volunteer role.
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. And let's see. I had some emails. Vivian in Green Bay called to ask if feral cats are treated at the guest facility.
No. So we work only with native wildlife. That's exactly what we're permitted for. Feral cats, unfortunately, are kind of the opposite.
Yeah.
Any domestic animal, whether they are, you know, a confirmed pet or a feral, would fall under a domestic species, and they would be treated at a regular veterinarian.
And who is it? I don't have the name here, but is there, or what is the most unusual situation you've had when it comes to care for an animal? Are there some, the more unusual situations?
I think probably the most, and it's hard to say what's unusual because, you know, for us, wildlife care is the norm. But I think the most unusual one, which is, I think, a classic, is that we did get a coyote in the winter that had gotten stuck inside a statue. And so it was a really cold time in the winter when we had major, major snow. And someone saw a coyote running through their yard with a statue on its head. And it took another day until the coyote was weak enough to just lay in the snow. And so we went and got the coyote and brought him in. And believe it or not, he had chased a rabbit into a statue of St. Francis, the patron saint of animals. Oh. So that was...
was the rabbit still in there?
Well, the part that he had, there was a couple parts left, but he definitely chased his food into a statue so hard that he got stuck. She got stuck. And so she had some damage on her neck, but it was as ironic as it gets. We don't name our animals, but we may or may not have referred to that one as Francis, for obvious reasons. So we see all kinds of different things, but I would say, in my opinion, the one that takes the cake for the last year would be Francis, thanks to St. Francis, the patron saint of animals.
Oh my God! And what's your website and that the Facebook page? People got to see that. But your website is Wildlife in. It's the Wildlife in Need Center.
Mm-hmm, correct.
So if people put that in, you're located in Oconomowoc, and people can find out how they can learn more and maybe donate, which is never a bad thing.
Nope, it's how we keep our doors open.
Alisa and Kim, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was a real pleasure, and I hope we can do this again down the road. You're doing wonderful work, and it is much appreciated by me and I think everybody else listening. So thank you.
Kim Bannick. Thank you, too, and thanks, everyone, for caring for our local wildlife.
Yeah, Kim Bannick and Alisa Fosco from the Wildlife in Need Center, Rehabilitator Center, located in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. They do a lot of good work. Coming up, we're going to take a look at some coyote research done right here in our state. I'm Larry Mueller. The Wisconsin Department, well, that's a little Joni Mitchell, by the way, isn't it? The song Coyote, one of her songs, and gets us into our little discussion about Wisconsin coyote research. The Wisconsin DNR has undertaken one of the largest studies of coyotes ever conducted between 2016 and 2019. 68 coyotes in Iowa and Grant counties were captured and collared. And when the collars transmitted a mortality alert, the reason for the coyotes' deaths was investigated by DNR. And we're joined by Daniel Storm, who is a deer research scientist for the Wisconsin DNR. The coyote mortality study was part of the Southwest Wisconsin CWD deer and predator study, and it's ongoing, as a matter of fact. And as we talk with Daniel Storm, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What do you want to know about coyotes in the state? Have you heard or seen them where you live? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Daniel Storm, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Larry. How are you doing?
Doing great. And here you are, a deer researcher. How'd you get involved with work? Yeah. Why are you working with coyotes in this instance?
Yeah, great question. So as you set it up really well, the coyote work was has been a part of our larger project, more centering around deer chronic wasting disease. And the primary impetus of that is trying to understand ultimately what is the population impact of chronic wasting disease on deer populations. So we have an expectation of kind of where our deer herd is headed as chronic wasting disease, unfortunately, continues to spread. But we want to, you know, if you're trying to understand chronic wasting disease and how that impacts deer populations, it only does so in the context of the other things that may or may not impact deer populations. So hunting and potentially predators. And of course, when we're working on deer in Wisconsin, there's always this expectation that hey, there's predators that may or may not be involved. And there's sort of this expectation that we include that as well. It really has opened up a lot of opportunities for us to learn about coyotes and bobcats just sort of for their own sake. And coyotes are not a tightly managed species like many of our other harvested wildlife species. And they're not that well studied in Wisconsin. So it was really a nice opportunity to sort of fold coyotes into this larger project and learn a few things.
Yeah, it sounds great. Well, talk a bit more about where they were captured and collared.
Sure. So they were mostly in Iowa County and a little bit in Grant County. So if you're familiar with Dodgeville area, just west of Madison in that beautiful, beautiful driftless area, mostly north of Highway 18 between that and the river. So that really beautiful driftless country, that's where we're doing the vast majority of our collaring. Yeah. And all on private, mostly on private properties. We had just tremendous support from private landowners allowing us to do work on their property. So that's kind of the where.
And it was pretty evenly split, or almost evenly split, between males and females.
Yep, that's right. And, when you're catching individuals, it's opportunistic. And so, you get what you get in terms of that sex ratio. And so it was pretty fortuitous.
Yeah, it was indeed. I'm wondering about the collars themselves and what they were programmed to do. You know, I was thinking, are you doing movements of the animals or what's going on there?
Yeah, so these are GPS collars. So just imagine, you have a GPS unit in your pocket right now, probably your phone, and people are familiar with their Garmins. It's very similar. What occurs with those collars, though, is that we will have a schedule programmed to get a location taken on that collar every so often, and it may be every hour, every 4 hours, twice a day, or whatever, and it may vary different times of the year. And then those locations, they're stored within the collar, but they're also transmitted via satellite to us. And so then we can go log in on the collar company's website, and we can, with just a minor lag of maybe half a day, see where each individual animal has been has been. So yes, we get really detailed location information, and it's like locationally precise, right? It's a GPS point. So you pretty much know where those animals are, and you know when they were, because obviously every location has a timestamp. So you're able to reconstruct basically where they lived and where they moved and all that. It's really cool.
Yeah, really cool. I mean, do they pretty much stay in a particular area? Just as an aside, I'm wondering.
I mean, the thing about coyotes is they're so, in a lot of animals, I think, especially as we have GPS collars that just give us so much more information than we ever had before, we find there's just a ton of variation between individuals. And coyotes especially, I mean, some coyotes, and of course it varies seasonally, right? During the summer, they might have pups. There's a lot of food in the landscape. There's a lot of cover on the landscape. They don't have to move as much to get what they need to live, right? There's all their prey, the rabbits and the squirrels there have reproduced. So they might have a smaller home range. Now, small from a coyote, still multiple square miles. And then in the wintertime, it may blow up to tens of square miles or so. And that's, you know, some individuals are what we call transient. They don't even, for at least periods of time, don't even settle within an established home range. Some disperse. We've had coyotes walk to Illinois. So, you know, it's really quite fascinating and variable with these animals.
But, and of course, a real interest is coyotes that died. And I, was it, how many have died since the study began, and how did they die?
Well, by the time, so, you know, at this point, the collars themselves have died if the animal hadn't died itself. And so we use the fate data because, and you'd mentioned this, but just real quick. So when the collar, in just a little bit more detail, but when the collar becomes motionless, that triggers something within the collar that we get an alert. So we'll get a text message and a text and an email that says, hey, collar number 8273, blah, 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 is in mortality mode. And that allows us to find the location of, you know, find that the location of that collar, which is almost, you know, in this case, going to be attached to a coyote. So that allows us to determine when. And so we know obviously when we collared them. So we're following their fates through time. So for each individual coyote, we have how long that they were alive for. You can use a bunch of statistics to calculate survival rates and what we call cause-specific mortality rate. So your probability of dying from cause X, Y, Z. So when we in wildlife, it's typical to look on an annual basis to say, okay, what percentage over a calendar year die or live? And so for our study, we had annual survival of 46%. So, and obviously then that means mortality of 54%. So a little bit higher than half, a little bit more than half of the coyotes would die within a year. And the vast majority of those were harvested. In fact, all but one of the coyotes that died was died from a human cause. So there was a lot of harvest. Most of that was from, say, hunting. Only there were a couple that were trapped, but most of that was from hunting. 6% was from vehicle collisions, and then about 1% was from, you know, what we call natural causes. And in this instance, it was only one animal. It appeared that this particular individual had died, succumbed from wounds from a fight with another coyote. But that happened once. And so like 47% of these animals over the course of a year were harvested.
Wow. I'm thinking about it. If half of them are dying, well, almost half of them are dying every year.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, you wonder how the heck are there so many coyotes out there?
Because they are remarkably adapted to dealing with that. And so it's fascinating. And so when I'm talking about this coyote stuff, I should mention that this aspect of the study has been published. So it's there's a we have a peer-reviewed scientific journal article called Survival and Cause-Specific Mortalities of Coyotes in Wisconsin. It was published just last year in the Journal of Mammalogy. So, and as an aside, folks can go to the DNR website and by searching wildlife research, they can eventually get to the link to that study if they want to read the actual, you know, scientific text. But one of the aspects of our research was like, okay, like I just said, hey, 54% annual mortality. Well, let's put that in broader context because with the other studies. And so we went and did what is called a meta-analysis. So we went and found all the prior studies on coyote mortality in North America from Texas to Alaska. And we kind of compiled those results and looked at, well, what's the average of that and what's the range of that? So in that meta-analysis, what we found was the average survival across all those studies on an annual basis of adults, because that's what we're talking about, adults. We're not, for when we collar, we're not doing pups, it's adults, mm-hmm. right? So 58% survival. So a little bit, I mean, so our survival is just a little bit below this sort of continental wide average of studies, again, going back to 60 years. So this is just, you know, a big review. And, but there's studies that showed 20 some percent survival, some that showed almost 90% survival. So huge, huge variation in adult survival. You asked, wow, that's a lot. That's a lot of mortality. How is there so many coyotes? And that's because of their remarkable ability of coyote populations to kind of compensate for that by, well, there's several things that happen when you have relatively high, in this case, harvest. One is that the other causes of mortality just occur much less frequently. And we saw that, like I said, you know, one coyote died from a fight. Well, let's just imagine these coyotes weren't harvested. Then they would have had more time to be subject to the other risks that these coyotes had. So probably more would have got hit by a car, more would have had a fight, whatever, more would have succumbed to some other cause. So you reduce harvest mortality. Well, to some extent, at least, other sources of mortality would come back in. And then what happens is when we have this sort of, so we've got this high harvest mortality, we've got lower mortality from other sources. There is also less competition among other coyotes. So you're not going to have that many. Like we had the one fighting death because there's not that, because the coyotes, there's just not going to be that much strife. There's plenty because they've got this higher harvest rate. There's more resources for those that are left over. So they're going to die less of other causes. They're also going to reproduce at higher rates. At low densities, coyotes can have larger litters. They're going to maybe have 7 pups, where at high densities, they may have like 4 pups. Pup survival may be lower in these high density populations relative to a lower density population. That, so we're having this sort of scenario, I think, in Wisconsin and in a lot of these states where there's more harvest, where we've just got a higher turnover. So we're losing more to harvest, but we're adding more in each spring because the ones left over just aren't competing with food. They're just able to really crank out more and more coyotes. And that's just, and that's, you know, that's, coyotes are great at that. Deer do that too, not nearly to the extent, but that's just a feature of these animals like coyotes that have just thrived in the face of, you know, civilization.
Daniel Storm, our guest today, a deer research scientist for the Wisconsin DNR, talking about this really interesting study done on coyotes here in Wisconsin. Questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about some Wisconsin DNR research on coyotes with Daniel Storm, a deer research scientist for the Wisconsin DNR. Really interesting study. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. You mentioned rabbits as a food source, I think, early on, Daniel. But they have a little broader menu than just rabbits, squirrels maybe. And what do they eat?
They eat whatever they can. So that's going to include a lot of small mammals, but they are omnivores to some extent. So if there's, you know, fruit mast, they may eat some of that. They obviously eat deer when they get a chance, whether that's predation on especially newborn deer the first couple months of life. Sometimes they will prey on adult deer, and certainly they will scavenge deer when they get a chance. You know, roadkills, gut piles, but they are capable, and I would say rarely in southern Wisconsin do prey on adult deer as well. But they are, you know, that's again one of their reasons that coyotes are so successful is they're so flexible in what they can, where they can live, and what they can eat.
A caller who declined to leave his name asked, why are we dealing with coyotes to begin with? Well, they are the worst and kill everything. They are not nice to have around.
I don't know. That's a research question. That's the values. And the thing about coyotes and the thing about, well, you know, values differ. And you know, there's no such thing as they're good or bad. That's just all a question of someone's values. So.
And they're eating mostly rabbits and rodents, but they also, I think they'll eat insects and plant matter and pretty much whatever they can eat.
Absolutely. Whatever they can. And, you know, they're a member of the biotic community, right? They're an animal. They're a wild animal. They've been around from time immemorial, and they will be around for the foreseeable future.
But what would you say to hunters who believe that coyotes need to be harvested to increase the white-tailed deer population in some areas?
Yeah, so that's a big question. And I think ultimately when it comes to coyote predation, I think hunters that feel that that's an important, that coyote harvesting is an important tool, I think they're going to kind of be disappointed in the results. One thing I just spoke about, their amazing ability to compensate. So you can just, they can sustain this high level of mortality. And there's been studies that have even, this is just, you know, the hunting that we have in Wisconsin is resulting in this high harvest rate, but there's been other studies that have purposefully tried to reduce coyote populations, and they just really can't over the long term because of the coyote's ability to bounce back so fast. And the other thing is this sort of compensating sort of mechanisms we're talking about with coyotes that applies to deer. If there's more deer, there's more competition between with food, there's more starvation, stuff like that. So I can tell you, you know, when we're thinking about our fawn survival, so as a part of the Southwest Project, we've done a fawn survival portion of that. In Southwest Wisconsin, the same study area, through August, we had between about 55 to 70% fawn survival. So between, you know, 40 to 30% of those fawns are dying during that early part of life. And most of that in southern Wisconsin is coyote predation. But it's really interesting to compare to other studies. So for instance, we also did fawn survival back in 2011, 2014. And one of those places was in Shawnee, Wapaka, Outagamie County, so west of Green Bay. And there, the survival, that survival from the first 3 months of life of fawns was the same. It was basically the same as it is in Southwest Wisconsin. However, there was much less coyote predation. There's much less predation of any sort. What there was more of was starvation. Fawns that were starving principally because their mothers didn't have enough energy to supply enough milk. That's what happens when you have these really high density deer populations. There's no, the animals can't just keep increasing forever. There are limits. And so, for instance, we had less coyote predation, but we had the same overall survival. So the predation itself isn't necessarily driving the overall survival. And in fact, there was a study in, I believe it was Delaware recently, a fawn survival study, and they had zero predation. They didn't have any predators in their study at all. And you know what their fawn survival rates were? About the same as what we get. Because they can't all live. They won't all live. There are limits to how many deer there can be on the landscape. There are limits to how many fawns are going to survive. That's just the reality that we're living in. So, that's my the answer. That's really that disappoints cool. So many people.
That is really interesting. I tell you, David Oshkosh has a question. Dave, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I came in late, so I might have missed it. I'm not sure. How does this study compare, or can it compare other ag areas that maybe have more cropland versus more forest?
Hmm.
Compare in terms of what? In terms of like the coyote survival or what?
Right.
Survival, yeah.
You know, I think it's really, that's a good question, and I don't know specifically. Like I said, we kind of compiled these studies across the continent, and I can tell you this, there wasn't really much of a regional difference. So like the Midwest versus the Southwest or whatever, there weren't big regional differences. That isn't to say that there wouldn't be landscape differences, and I don't really know. I think it really all just depends on. Yeah, I'm not. I guess I can't really say for sure. I'd hate to venture to ask, so I apologize for that.
Gene and Merrill, we'll go to you. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Hi, Larry. Thanks. Yeah, I'm wondering if coyotes pose any threat to horses, because mostly those animals are enclosed and have limited running area if they do.
Yeah, good question. And I'll say I just have to couch this by saying that's kind of out of my expertise. I am not aware of coyotes causing problems with horses, but don't take that any farther than that I'm not aware of it. So I apologize, but you know, we've got wildlife. This Wisconsin DNR has a wildlife damage program. We've got, you know, you can always contact your local wildlife biologist as well. And so there's plenty of folks in the DNR that can help with those sorts of questions. Unfortunately, I'm not really one of them.
And I think Sean, who came in late, wonders where can the coyote study be found and is it accessible to the public? And it is indeed accessible.
Yeah. I mean, I would just go on the Wisconsin DNR website and there's a search bar and you can type in deer research or CWD research or Southwest CWD deer. There's a few things you can just search, and it's really easy to find. And we've got a newsletter, a project newsletter. We've got many back issues. You can subscribe to the newsletter. It comes out several times a year with articles and descriptions of different findings. And we've got links to the actual, all the scientific publications that we produce, not just this project, but just all of our wildlife research and fisheries research as well. I'm always struck by how, you know, I feel like we do a lot of outreach, but I'm really struck by there's a lot of people that just aren't aware of just how much we've done and how much we do have available for folks to read. So I really encourage folks to take a look at that.
Yeah, and that specific coyote research and bobcat research is right on that website. And it's, by the way, I really like that website.
Oh, good. I'll pass that info on.
I think it's really useful and user-friendly kind of website. And so I really appreciate that very much. And you know what? Here we are at the end of the show, and every one of my lines are filled. I think, Daniel, we'll have to have you back.
Sure thing. I'd love to. I've got lots of I can ramble forever, so well, feel free.
It was great talking with you, and we'll get Daniel back and we'll talk some more because there's plenty of other questions here about deer and deer populations as well. Daniel Storm, deer research scientist for the Wisconsin DNR, our guest today. Great to have him with us. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's the way it works sometimes. Lots of team members here that I just wanted to mention. Our producers for the show, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive director, of course, is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening. That was a great show today. And there's lots more in store here on WPR News. Again, I'm Larry Mueller.